सोच विचार के साथ मेरा नाम नदीम उल हक है
और मेरा नाम अंजुम अल्ताफ है.
वेलकम टू सोच विचार. टुडे आई एम स्पेशली हैप्पी टू इंट्रोड्यूस एन ओल्ड फ्रेंड, वन ऑफ माय अर्ली मेंटर्स इन पीआईडी, खलील हमदानी, हु इज पाकिस्तानी बट lived in America for a long time and then came after his PhD to the PID to guide a number of us young Pakistanis, and we owe him a lot in terms of our development as an economist. Then Khalid went back and joined the UN and moved to Geneva and became a director in UNCTAD, UN Conference on Trade and Development. So Khalil Hamdani has a very long experience in development economics, trade, investment, etc. So we're going to have a wide-ranging discussion on development issues and get you a different perspective of a Pakistani who lived overseas and worked in the UN agencies. So quite similar to me, but nevertheless, a different perspective. So welcome, Khalil.
Thank you, Nadeem. And it's always a pleasure to be back in Pakistan, although it's for two short visits.
So tell me, Khalil, now, what is your view, looking back? Remember, I love looking back since I wrote a book on that. What is your view on the development experience that you've had over the last 30 years? You've been doing development policy. How do you see development policy, and what has your role been, and how would you do it differently if you had to?
Yeah, well, in the UN, I've been personally advising countries on attracting foreign direct investment and in trying to not just get it, but to try to use it to promote their own development. And some countries have done well. We know about the Asian tigers, but of course they don't need assistance from the UN. But we have been working with countries in Africa, Ethiopia, Kenya, Tanzania, South Africa, Ghana, it's easy to put in place policies to attract investment, particularly foreign investment. And if you give them the right incentives, of course, they will come. And if you have basic raw materials, resources, then of course, it's a done deal. But getting anything more out of it, that requires a lot of effort. It requires a development state, progressive government, and enabling people, enabling workers. And that is, of course, much more difficult. Because you can have a large population, but if the population is not empowered, then it's a constraint.
Why do we want foreign investment, Khalid? Think about it from the point of view of Pakistan, let's say. Why should Pakistan be bending over backwards to get foreign investment? We've been doing that for 70 years. And we get very little, but we still beg and borrow and we run around getting foreign investment. Why should we?
We want it because of technology. We want linkages with the international supply chains and into integrated production. We may not be getting it, but we want it. And of course,
yeah, but can't we get it without getting foreign investment? Must we, for example, we are willing to sign all kinds of deals to give foreign investments all kinds of tax exemptions, all kinds of advantages over local investors. Is that something we should do?
Not over local investors. Mm-hmm. That is sometimes overzealous. Government officials who do that. The investment agencies, of course, are supposed to give equal treatment at worst and preferably preferences to their domestic investors. By preferences, I don't mean subsidies, but it's a question of giving them equal access to government procedures and other administrative requirements, which foreign investors tend to get favored. Mm-hmm. And so this equal, what we call level trading
But think about it this way. Like, for example, we have given foreign investors a lot of protection in our car industry for the last 50 years. Mm-hmm. And we are continuing to give them more protection.
That's a mistake.
And those guys are not exporting anything. They're only feeding a domestic market.
Yeah.
And with the result that the domestic market, the cars in the domestic market don't have good quality. And people are precluded from buying good quality cars from the foreign market. Now, we did all this to get foreign investment technology. And we've been doing it for 50 years. Now, how long should we continue to do this?
Well, the mistake was not to get the foreign investors here. The mistake was not to work with the foreign investors to get them to also be value creating in terms of the global markets. Mm-hmm. The same companies like Toyota, Honda, and the like have operations here which are working towards the domestic market. But the same companies are working in Thailand, in Malaysia, in Singapore, and they are working for global supply chains, export, and producing cars for export to the U.S. market. Okay? So, so we haven't really challenged Nissan and Toyota to do value creation in Pakistan.
But look, the problem that I have is that these companies are the conglomerates, they are giants. Some of these companies are bigger than Pakistan, right? Mm-hmm. In terms of GDP or size or whatever. Now, these companies have better negotiating powers and skills than us, right? And they've got the big governments backing them up. Mm-hmm. Now, if I look at the political economy of foreign investment, once we get them in, their governments back them up, their governments push them, and even to bring them in, the governments push them. And they're signing these contracts that may not be in our favor. And how can we get past that? A country that doesn't have the capacity to negotiate, a country that is kind of handicapped in many ways, with the result that we lose our own investor base, they go somewhere else and we bring these guys in. Now, I'm struggling with that. How do I deal with that?
Hmm. Well, pharmaceutical sector. Right? You have the big companies here since independence, but you tell them how to price their products, and therefore a huge market like Pakistan is not competitive. And where we have been able to be operational in world markets is in terms of our generic products. Mm-hmm. So, and our generic companies are Pakistani producers. Mm-hmm. So, and if you want the Abbott and the other big pharmaceuticals to be using Pakistan as a base, then you have to give them free rein in terms of how to price their products and how to market it worldwide. Okay? And this is a problem in across the board in all the industries. We tell them how to price the product, and then they see Pakistan as basically...
Okay, that's a point that I take. But think about it again, Khalil, that yes, I agree with you that we need foreign investment and we need to bring them in. But I think, quite frankly, isn't... What I find a more important thing to do probably is to get our own investment rate up. I mean, in Pakistan, for example, and most of Africa, investment rates are still very low. In Pakistan especially now, I know private investment rate is something like 9% of GDP. Government has another 6% or something, so we get to about 15% of GDP. Mm-hmm. China, as you know, is about 40% of GDP. India is 30% of GDP. But our government is so interested, thanks to people like yourself and UN giving us this advice, our government is so interested in doing, in trying to attract foreign investors. They bend over backwards, give them tax breaks, give them this, give them that, and let the company come in, let those companies come in. But our investor base is eroding all the time. Should the emphasis not be on getting the investment in our own countries up?
Yes, but it's a question of chicken and egg. Even before we tried to attract investment, we were failing our own domestic private sector. Okay? Mm-hmm. So ever since who was it, Mahbubullah, who talked about the 20 families?
22 families, yeah.
22, ever since then, we have gone out of our way to make life miserable for domestic industry. Those businessmen who operate
that can't be
operate on a rentier.
That's 60 years ago. Mahbubullah said that 60 years ago.
Rentier basis. Mm-hmm. And and then, of course, if investment is not picking up, which it should, mm-hmm. Foreign investment is the fallback. And even foreign investors will tell you, we will only invest if your domestic private sector is investing. Mm-hmm. And mm-hmm. certainly that's
it. So exactly. So what would you recommend to get our investment up? I mean, since, you know, let's broaden the debate a little. We talked about foreign investment, domestic investment. Let's broaden it a little and let's talk about development in general. Mm. So remember when you came to Pakistan, we were talking about 1973 or something, and you come back in 2018 now, and you see, yeah, we've progressed. I won't say we haven't done anything, but we haven't made the kind of progress that you expected in 1973. How do we get that progress going?
Mm. Well, there's a lot of change here. You know, in many respects, our society is globalized. Our people are working all over the Middle East. They're sending back remittances, and with the remittances comes a lifestyle which people enjoy. But the business sector is too short term. They want to make quick profits. And making a lifetime commitment in terms of industry, enjoying the work and passing it down father to son is something that has somehow not taken hold of in a big way, which is unfortunate. Mm-hmm. And it certainly is something that you see in...
No, but Khalil, I think you're dodging the question. Think about it. We have had, since 1973 to now, I'm saying we've grown. But in per capita terms, we've hardly grown at 2% per annum. I think the average growth rate is something like, I could be wrong by a few decimal points, but I think the average growth rate over this period couldn't have been more than 5%, maybe even, you know, let's say 5%. So with population growth rate roughly 3%, we've grown at per capita of 2%. Now that means that our GDP will double in about 100 years, 50 years, which is a very slow rate. And we are not going to catch up with the rest of the world. Now, the key question that economists like you must face is, how can we grow at a higher rate so that we can do development? Because without growth, I don't think we can do development. Or would you say we can do development without growth?
Well, you have poverty. Mm-hmm. You have a whole question of human resource development, tackling that inequality, getting the very large... potential labor force out there to get them empowered, to get them working. You have the gender issues, how we treat women, unless these are all very difficult questions tied up with social issues and the like.
So then what you're telling me is that economics is kind of useless. We should only worry about social and cultural aspects, right? I mean, so what is
we,
what?
We
so what is this?
Worry about those aspects, but we don't.
So then, what you're telling me is that for the next 2 days, you're going to have this big conference in the Lahore School of Economics with talking about growth, etc. But you've got nothing really to say to us. Is that right?
In terms of the question that you're raising, probably not. But I'm sure there are other minds working on those issues. The question of poverty, of course, is something we are all seized with.
But look, isn't it correct that there can be no alleviation of poverty unless the economy grows at a higher rate than 2% per capita?
I would say 3%. So
it has to grow at a higher rate than 2%, right?
Yes.
It has to grow at a much higher rate so that poverty can be alleviated. Without growth, I don't think we can alleviate poverty. So growth becomes central. And what I'm asking you is, in all your years in UNCTAD, etc., all over the world, UN, What have we learned about development that we can talk about now? Give me three ideas that you think that we should put in priority in Pakistan.
We need to education. We need to work with our youth and give them the skills to be operational in the 21st century. And then we need to give them jobs.
Okay. Yeah. So you're saying education and jobs, yeah. Right? Now the question is, I don't see how we can generate jobs unless there is investment at home. Right? The foreign investor is not going to come in and do all the investment. As you said, the bulk of the investment has to be local. Foreign investment is really icing on the cake. Now, so there's something preventing investment from taking place in our countries. Right?
Yeah.
Second thing is that education. Yeah. Well, as I told you, Khalil, just now, we've been investing in education. We've got 200 plus universities that we made over the last few, you know, 2-3 decades. And we've got... We've invested quite a bit in schools.
That's not enough. But if you have a population of 200 million, 200 universities are a good beginning, but you need much more than that.
Okay.
And in addition to jobs, it's entrepreneurship you need. If you want to revive the business, the small, medium-sized enterprise sector, and the service sector, you need to... The population needs to create jobs. Mm-hmm. You can't just ask government to create jobs for you.
Mm-hmm.
So so all those three factors need to...
So what's preventing entrepreneurship investment from taking place? And what's preventing our education sector? We've had a large number of loans from the World Bank, grants from DFID, grants from USAID. UN has come in and done a number of human development reports and number of, you know, human development type things. But I don't think we've made much progress. If I look at the indicators around the world, let's take competitiveness, whatever, we haven't made much progress. We haven't moved up. So something has to give, and you economists have to tell me what it is.
I'm not sure the economists have the solution to that. Right? All we do is we provide tools for finding out whether progress is being made.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, whether progress must be made by government, by people, and even by men and women and youth themselves. We tell you that look at your growth rates, there's something wrong. Perhaps you need to fix this part or that part, but that's about it. Okay, we maybe help you improve.
So tell us, what would you recommend that we do? I mean, I know all the donor agencies. I've done that in my life. You've done that in your life. We go to these countries. We leave these glossy reports. We tell them what to do, etc. So please tell us, what should we do? We've got a problem here. Our growth rate is not picking up. Education quality is not going up. Jobs are not being created. Investment is not picking up. So there must be some suggestions that you have, even if not complete suggestion. What are the areas that you think we should be looking at?
We need to get our agricultural sector moving.
Okay.
Yeah, we need to get productivity, raise it through capacity building, through working with the institutions. We have a lot of institutions, more than 200 institutions.
You mean universities?
Yeah.
I think institutions are different. I mean, let's talk about institutions. What do you mean we have a lot of institutions?
In terms of improving agricultural output, extension, agricultural extension institutions, we've had them for a long time.
But Khalil, agriculture is a declining sector. Agriculture, when you were here in 1973, was 50% of GDP. Today, agriculture is 18% of GDP, or 20%, something like that. Industry is also about 18-20% of GDP. 60% is the service sector. And so if we keep harping on agriculture, fair enough, I agree, agriculture productivity go up, agriculture produce could go up, etc., etc. But even if we increase agriculture productivity by 20%, right, given that agriculture is almost 20%, we would have no more than 2% of growth coming out of that, right? We still need a large number of growth impact factors coming out of the rest of the economy.
That's correct. But if you look at our track record over the last 20 years, the years when we've done well is years when we've had good agriculture. So agriculture is sort of a platform from which to, to the extent we have it, we need to get maximum momentum out of it.
Okay.
Then we have our traditional exports, garments, textiles, which is also a declining industry worldwide, but for us, it's a mainstay. So we need to listen to what the businessmen say there and how to keep them competitive and productive. Then we need to look at other potential export areas.
But let me return to you to this thing that I learned in Chicago by Milton Friedman. He said, look, you economists, you don't know which sectors are going to do well. You don't know which products to export or sell or whatever. Because if you do, then go out and make money. Otherwise, stop giving advice to people. So would you agree with that? Can we economists tell people what to export, what not to export, and what to produce and what not to produce?
The economists should not be telling business members, should be listening to what businessmen say. But if the businessmen tell you that they face all kinds of regulatory hurdles, that other industries are receiving subsidies and they are not receiving it, then and government needs to know, comes and asks economists, well, is that correct? And how can we correct the level playing field that that industry wants? That's where the policy advice comes in. So, but you're quite right. It's industry that knows how to fix itself.
Yeah, but there's also a moral hazard problem here. If you listen to industry too much, they only talk about getting subsidies. Like if you listen to the car industry, the textile industry, whatever, they want either more protection or more subsidies or whatever. They themselves don't want a level playing field. And this is not just true in Pakistan, it's also true in the States. As you can see right now what's happening in the States, industries there have also lobbied to get advantage over other competitors.
Yeah.
And I think we have to worry about that too.
Well, the subsidies have a role to play, but they must be linked to performance. If an industry leader says he needs this sort of protection to raise the output by so much and to penetrate certain export markets, you say, fine, let's do it, but it must be time-bound. And you need to monitor a year later whether, in fact, those targets expectations were met. And if they were not, then perhaps...
The problem is, can we have a credible contract? Because the moment that guy makes a huge amount of profit, and this point is being made by Raghuram Rajan, the former central bank governor of India, but also professor at Chicago, that once they make a lot of money, they will use that money to lobby to keep their subsidy alive. And once they start lobbying, then it's very difficult to... I mean, the famous example of that is the gun law in the U.S., that the lobbies are keeping the gun law alive even though the children are marching on the streets. So how do we deal with that issue?
Well, maybe you have to live with that issue. So in the gun law, the big manufacturer of guns, Remington, declared bankruptcy earlier this week. So... so eventually subsidies will peter out and you will not be able to maintain productivity over time. So you simply have to ride it out. And of course, hopefully, new generations of politicians will come in who will be accountable to the people. And people will at some point or another... the opposite of Gresham's law... The good will drive out the bad at some point, hopefully.
Okay, interesting enough, let me take you in another direction. I mean, you were at PAD, I was with you at that time, then I went to the government, and you've had experience of government all over the world, etc. How have you seen developing countries make policy?
very uneven. Mm-hmm. Yeah. There are very few Asian tigers. Mm-hmm. And even those Asian tigers, if you go and look into the policy making, mm-hmm. it's a lot of industry working hand in hand with government. Mm-hmm. Some things which you might not approve of, but they get the business done. Mm-hmm. So, and so it depends how you measure results. So,
and what about the poorer countries, countries like Pakistan? I mean, how do you think Pakistan gets its policy made?
How does it get policies made? It has its budget, mm-hmm. annual budget, mm-hmm. and it has its agencies like the customs and internal revenue mm-hmm. and the like, who are mm-hmm. fiefdoms on their own respect, mm-hmm. And then there are institutions which have been there for many years, which just continue to operate. Mm-hmm. Okay.
Mm-hmm. So what you're saying is that's more inertia than policy. Let's say if they want a new industrial policy, or let's say they want a new macroeconomic policy, so how do you get that made?
You have the Planning Commission.
The Planning Commission is dysfunctional.
Okay.
That and produces, nobody listens to it.
Every 5 years, they produce a plan. What is the 11th plan?
Yeah, but I mean, nobody reads it. Nobody looks at it.
Okay. Yeah. So, and then you have various boards that occasionally the Prime Minister chairs. Right now there's...
those are ceremonial meetings.
So, and...
But the real policy, as far as I can see, is made by... IMF. International agencies, IMF, UN, World Bank, even the aid agencies, DFID, World Bank, USAID, all these guys get policies made all the time.
Yeah.
And they go to the government, to the ministers. The ministers don't have time to think about it, whatever. They sign them and it becomes a policy. So, but the point is that their consultants come and write these policies. It's become a very easy way of doing policy. You don't have to work hard, you don't have to do anything, and you get an international stamp of approval. So that's how they make policy. But then the problem is the consultant is not accountable. So what do you do?
It's not difficult to make policy. Okay? And we have a lot of Pakistanis in these institutions, so certainly they are aware of the situation here.
Sorry, where did you say we had Pakistanis?
In the IMF, for example.
No, that's different. When I was in the IMF, you were in the UN. Yeah, but we didn't have any... I couldn't even work on Pakistan.
Hmm.
I mean, there was a rule. I can't work on Pakistan.
Yeah.
That is, it's outside my purview. So, yeah, most of the policies... it has to be by definition.
Yeah.
You don't want a conflict of interest. If you're working on a country, there's a conflict of interest. So that's fine. But I think... Let's look at it this way. How many Pakistanis are there?
The failure is to implement policy. Yeah, and
would you say the failure is to implement policy only, or is it the failure to make good policy?
Policy is good in retrospect; it becomes bad, right? So
no, not necessarily. I think you can design a good policy. Correct me if I'm wrong. You can design a good policy if you think about it, if you research it well, if you debate it well, if you discuss it well within the country. You have all kinds of inputs, etc., then you can have a good policy.
Mm-hmm.
And then again, implementation also is not divorced from the making of the policy, because implementation has to be a part of making the policy, right? Because you have to monitor it, you have to ensure that it works, etc. So unless you've done your own research and thinking, you can't make a good policy. Am I wrong, or would you agree with that?
You need ownership of the policy, mm-hmm. Not just at the implementation phase, but also in the formulation phase.
So how can I have ownership if the policy has been made by DFID or the USAID?
DFID and USAID have big operations in Pakistan.
Yeah. Right?
They do surveys.
Huge operations.
They work, and they work with national institutions, they work with NGOs, and hopefully it's a bottom-up process. And to an extent, they probably bring certain preconceived best practice from overseas. Mm-hmm. But it needs to be all mixed and
sorry, let me break that up in parts. You said they work with donors, NGOs, they bring in best practice from overseas, but then the consultants come here, live in the Marriott, in Islamabad, in five-star luxury, sit in Islamabad, and they put together the policy because the best practice comes on their computer. And I think that's a good way to develop.
It's one way of that's how the international industry operates.
Okay.
The developing industry operates.
And it has been very successful in your mind?
In some places.
Where? Can you give me an example of where it's been successful? I'm looking for an example. Can you tell me where it's been successful?
It's been,
I mean, the biggest success in the world has not followed this model at all,
mm-hmm.
which is China. China has never followed the international model. China has done its own thing, totally homegrown, and the international model has always come back and ratified what China has done.
Correct. Right? But in the case of China, for instance, foreign investment,
mm-hmm.
when they opened up, they invited the UN. I was part of the group that went to China. We gave them a lot of advice, a lot of best practice.
Mm-hmm.
They thanked us. They gave us a big dinner, banquet. And then they did their own thing.
That's the important thing. But what I'm talking about is they did their own thing. I've been to China many times, so they run the same thing. The important thing is China has got the right approach. They listen to everyone. They listen to the world.
Mm-hmm.
They don't try and rush into anything. But they do their own thing. And I'm all for that. I'm not saying close your mind. I'm not saying become a frog in the well. I'm saying listen to everybody, but you have to do your own thinking. Now, in Pakistan, what has happened is the government has decided that they don't want to do any research at all, and we'll all outsource it all to the donors. Let the donors do all the research. We will not do any research. So our government institutions, our policy, ministries, our think tanks don't do any research. Everybody follows the donors.
Well, that's wrong. Okay? You need to, in the same way as you, as the Koreans reverse engineered basic products like the car, Pakistanis need to reverse engineer economic thinking and its application to the realities in the country.
That's a very good way to put it. Exactly right. We have to not accept best practice, but we have to reverse engineer it and try to understand what happened in the world. Obviously, the knowledge pool is global and we have to draw on it.
Mm.
But the solutions have to be local and we have to kind of think them through.
Mm.
And that's where the earlier what you said about tastes and cultures and our local ethics and practices, etc., has to come in. That has to taint our thinking and begin to shape our thinking.
But Nadeem, didn't we do this at one point, or weren't there occasionally times when we tried to do this? I'm thinking back about 10 years ago, there was this effort to homegrown approach to IMF adjustment.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know where that went. And didn't people like Mahbub ul Haq back in the 60s do give credence at least to national planning?
I think in the 60s, Mahbub ul Haq did, and it worked for a while, right? But like all models, things, change, and things change. And Mahbub ul Haq's model, that old planning model, which worked in the first one or two plans, then needed to be changed because the world global environment changed, Pakistan's environment changed. We became a more open economy. We had more deregulation, etc. So we needed to change our model, which we did. Now, the homegrown program that you said, I mean, there's really never been an effort to make a homegrown program.
Yeah.
There's probably been a conference funded by somebody that we talked about it for a little while, forgot about it. That doesn't mean anything. There's been no sustained interest, as far as I can see, in developing alternative models, thinking alternative things. And that's where what I mentioned earlier, once we talked about it earlier, that's where the failure of the economics profession is, because there's really no debate among the economics profession on a fresh model.
Mm.
Do you see it that way, or do you see it different?
Well, it's certainly a legitimate criticism that we need to face in a non-defensive manner.
Mm.
I would hope that our institutions are addressing that issue.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Our Pakistan Institute Developing Economics, Lahore University, and in Karachi as well, there are a number of think tanks that hopefully are working on it.
Mm-hmm.
But tell me, you live here.
Mm-hmm.
Do you see any bright spots
In terms of thinking, no. In terms of the economy, yes. The middle class is growing. Yes, demand is growing thanks to remittances, etc. there are things happening in this country, mainly because of population growth rate, mainly because of our international linkages, globalization, etc. So yes, things are happening in this country that lie beyond the pale of the government. I keep saying that the best thing that could happen to us is if Islamabad would just fold up, right? And Islamabad would just stop interfering in the economy, that could be the best thing that could happen. But that is not happening. But having said that, that good things are happening, there is also a big, big intellectual vacuum, which you can see in terms of the political debate that is taking place right now. The political debate is amongst the politicians who are absolutely clueless and who also are venal. They want to just make get money and power. And the intellectuals are absent from it. In terms of economic policy, the intellectuals are absent from it. In terms of social policy, intellectuals are absent from it. So there is no intellectual debate. However, I would add, there is one intellectual network that is very active in this country, whereas the rest of us have failed. One intellectual network is very active, and that is effective. That is the fundamentalist network. They influence policy. They control policy. And because we don't have a network, we can't talk to each other. We have no say, not even a voice in policy. So policy is being set by the fundamentalists, and if to the extent it is being set, mostly it is not being set. And the donors are making a separate effort to, which is confined to Islamabad, right? Tiny little efforts here and there, which I think are very big, but they're not, they amount to nothing at all. So that's the picture in Pakistan. Economically, it's not a mess, it's not a disaster. Things are happening,
yeah.
But intellectually, it's failing.
Well, that's a dismal picture you're painting.
Mm-hmm. It is.
And hopefully one would expect some change. After all, it is a country with a lot of history behind it,
yeah.
Even going back before 1947. We need to break out from these fiefdoms that we have and try to see development as more than making a quick buck.
Correct. So let me ask you two final questions. One is, which I ask most of my guests, since you've been involved in research and thinking all your life, give some ideas, because I think most of my audience is students and, you know, thinkers. Give some ideas to people who might want to do some, let's say, an MA thesis or want to do a small research paper or whatever. Give some ideas for topics that you think would be useful for people to study.
I think, I'm right now with the Lahore School of Economics, and I am working with students there in terms of thesis that they have to do at the graduate level. I think I encourage the students to move a little bit away from too much reliance on econometric techniques, applying certain package computer programs to run data over time series and trying to do all sorts of very sophisticated calculations. I encourage them to focus on more basic ideas and try to do some empirical work. Try to do surveys, go out there and if you're working on industry, to go and work with two or three industries and try to find out exactly how they operate, what problems they face, and then come back with some basic recommendations, not necessarily based on very clever econometric techniques.
Khalil, that's very interesting. I do the same, and I must remind you, this is almost full circle from where we began. I remember coming to the PhD and you telling me to do some econometrics and us doing econometric work. And now it's very interesting that maybe it's life cycle or whatever, that we are telling kids to be more cerebral and not more technique oriented. So that's interesting to know. Final thing that I'd like to ask you is, I always ask my guests to give a recommendation of a book that's influenced you a lot, or a movie, or whatever you think, something that you think it's absolutely imperative for kids to kind of study or look at or whatever to for their development.
Hmm. Yeah. So that's a hard one. Mm-hmm. I imagine that all kids have a certain basic curriculum that they follow, and the idea would be to get away from that and try to look at more radical thinking, or if for no other reason than to find faults in it.
Mm-hmm.
Your own book is one of those that one could look at simply to get a different perspective. And I suppose one should go back and read some of the basic fundamentals, you know, the Adam Smiths and all, as they wrote it, rather than how they are interpreted.
So you'd recommend reading the classics again? Or at least once.
Once.
Okay, great. Thank you, Khalil. That is wonderful. Thank you very much.
Okay, yeah, well, always a pleasure to chat with you, Nadeem.
Thank you.
सोच विचार के साथ मेरा नाम नदीम उल हक है और मेरा नाम अंजुम अल्ताफ है।